So let's start. So thank you everyone for joining, and we have some people who actually woke up pretty early to be here in the US. So thank you everyone. As I mentioned to all of you and in various blog posts, the idea behind this Hangout was we released the PDF with your six answer to the six question on immutable infrastructure, and immediately I got a few requests saying, "Ah, can we organize a chat?" Someone said, "You know, let's do an IRC or a Twitter chat." I hate Twitter chats and Twitter discussion. You know, they become very unwindly. So I propose to do an Hangout. Thank you everyone for accepting to do it. I will not, as promised, introduce every single one of you. I would like you to do it yourself, and then we can start chatting about immutable infrastructure. For all the viewers, anytime, feel free to use the Q&A box to ask questions, and whoever wants to answer them will pick them up. So let me just say, you know, Andrew, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, I'm one of those who was got up early this morning in the US. My name's Andrew Phillips. I'm the VP of Product Management for a company called ZB Labs. We make continuous delivery and DevOps tools for enterprise scale kind of issues. And the main challenge, I guess, for appearing here is that I'm certainly not immutable because I spent most of yesterday eating Thanksgiving turkey. So that's a kind of setting the scene for this one. That's me, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what your thoughts, questions are on this idea. I think we'll get a lot of good discussion out of this because I've seen also everybody has slightly different views on the topic, which makes for a great starting point. And looking forward to hearing what everybody has to say.
Cool, thank you. Florian?
Sure. Hey, I'm Flo. I'm CTO at CodeChip. CodeChip is a continuous delivery service. We've been using immutable infrastructure for our infrastructure since basically forever. I love that more teams pick it up now and see it as a viable alternative to how to build your infrastructure. And yeah, looking forward to talking after all the answers that you guys have already given.
Thank you. Julian?
Hi, good morning. My name is Julian Dunn. I'm the engineering manager. I'm an engineering manager at Chef. Chef Software, we make the configuration management platform, eponymously known as Chef. And, you know, we get asked a lot of times about, so how does Docker play well with Chef? And I wanted to point out that there's a long history of immutable infrastructure before Docker even existed, and there's a lot of lessons that can be learned from a lot of the work that's been done already. So I'm looking forward to having the discussion with everyone.
Cool. Keith?
Hi, I'm Keith Norris. I'm a continuous delivery practice lead for Europe for ThoughtWorks. We basically do consulting. We help out organizations that want to get better at delivering software and want help delivering software.
Cool. And Matthew?
Hi, I'm Matthew Skelton. I'm a co-founder and principal consultant at Skelton Thatcher Consulting, and we help our clients to make the changes to technologies and teams that are needed for building and operating systems with this thing called cloud.
Cool. I'm useless, so I'm going to be quick. I'm Marco. I run HiOps. We concentrate more on the ops side of DevOps. I'm just the moderator, so I have no useful opinion whatsoever on this. to kick things off, I would just follow the original six questions. Right. So, and the first one was, what does immutable infrastructure mean to you? And I did ask you guys this question because while the concept, by and large, you know, it's understood, every time I speak to someone, the details are different, right? Which I think is great, but it was really interesting to see the difference in opinions you've got. So it's totally open. I don't think we need to go in line. Whoever wants to start answering what does it mean for you is welcome.
I'll start. So to me, immutable infrastructure means that in contrast to, we have infrastructure elements where traditionally they would kind of persist and you would, as you needed to make changes, you would make changes to those existing pieces of infrastructure. So the server is kind of the classical unit, server instance. With immutable infrastructure, instead what you do is you essentially rebuild that element and for its duration of its life, it does not change. If you need to change it, you do that by creating a new instance of that element.
Yeah, I think just to jump in on that, I think, first of all, yeah, that's I think fully in line, at least the way I look at it. But I think that the reality has always been in this space, in the operational management space, that there is always some bit that you do not want to change and some bit that you do want to change. And really what the discussion as it goes today has kind of moved the boundary. I think it's, as has already been said, this is not a new concept, right? We've been talking about the idea that, for instance, your code is immutable for ages. If you want to release a new version of a WAR file, for instance, or a gem or whatever, you don't just go in on the production server and edit the code. You fix the source and then you upload a new version of that particular gem or WAR file or whatever. Now we're moving the boundary to the point where we're typically talking about the quote-unquote entire server or process, if you're a container really, and file system being immutable and versionable in the same sense. I think we're still not at the point where people would say, for instance, whenever you want to like change a container, we're going to reinstall the underlying OS or we're going to reinstall the hypervisor. So there's always still an element of mutability in your setup. I think realistically speaking, what we're talking about is moving the boundary between the stuff that is versioned and the stuff that is not versioned further towards the sort of low-level end of the system.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to... Sorry, go ahead, Flo.
I think that one thing that is that we always talk about, I always talk about, I think that is very important, that you have always the ability to rebuild everything from the layer that you control. So if you run on Amazon, like you need to be able to rebuild from a completely fresh Amazon AMI. So whatever layer you have under control, like you need the automation in place for immutable infrastructure to rebuild really everything completely from scratch. And that you don't have the full control over every layer necessarily, but you need to be able to go from the first thing that you have.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Amazon because there's lots of folks out there that have already been doing immutable infrastructure for a very long time, or trying to anyway. Like Netflix is the perfect example of this, where yeah, every time they deploy, they just simply bake out a new AMI and then start spinning up machines with that AMI, and then if it works, they just bring down all the old machines that are running the old AMI, and there you go, right?
Maybe to jump in on that one, I mean, I think that's a very good and practical point that Flo made about basically wanting to be versionable and immutable as per the layer you control. And I think that raises another interesting question around, so how much do you know about the layer that you don't control? Because, of course, there is some dependency from your stuff on the other stuff. So I take a base example, you're running in a pass. That pass will have some version internally, say OpenShift or Cloud Foundry or whatever, but as a consumer, you typically won't necessarily know about it. So there is still this interesting, you know, your immutable world is still dependent on a kind of mutable world that you maybe don't even control if you take this approach. And I think that's a bit of an unsolved problem, how you are notified of the fact that things change in that mutable world and what kind of impact that has on you. But maybe that's a discussion for a little later once we've talked about the immutable side a bit more, which I think was the point of this chat.
I think that up to a point, like you'll need to see it as a given that if you use a platform as a service provider, they like that's the service that they provide. They have a consistent infrastructure that when they have to coming with immutable infrastructure, change in going more with services. So it's not, I think it's not the time anymore, like where people build all of it themselves, but there is a service for pretty much everything at this point. And it just, immutable infrastructure helps to make best use of mostly those cloud services. But I think that this implicit trust that we put into other services, other people providing like a consistent infrastructure and a consistent system is really important.
Yeah, I think there's going to actually be a lot of passes built on Docker in the future, too. I think that's you know, a definite use case where that's going to shine because it provides a really easy interface for folks to build a pass and to have a basically deploying an application into a standard framework. So I totally see, you know, that's the way people are going to go.
Right. Is this an entry in the second question, which was very interesting because you have diverging, somewhat diverging opinions. So what's your position on immutable infrastructure and why? You know, everyone is very positive. Everyone says it's something to, you know, look into. But there was also some answers about, you know, it's a myth. Because in reality, you know, no matter how hard you try, there are things at the hardware level that is going to change, you know, the content of memory or the network packets, they are going to change, right? So the system will not really be immutable. So is this something, Andrew, you were hinting at when you said we need to get into the definition of immutable?
Well, I can take that since you called me out specifically. I think Florian made an excellent point here to say that, you know, it helps to align the world that you can't control with the world that you can't make immutable. And where you choose that boundary will depends on how much control you have over the setup. If you're at an outsourced hosting provider, you probably don't control the racks and the network cables and the electrons going back and forth and all that kind of stuff. I think the one interesting dimension to this is that there, of course, there is parts of the world that you typically control where immutability is still challenging, and that is all your transactional data. And I think that's an interesting, because when we talk about immutable servers in general, you know, people talk about like the computational part of the system, not so much the data part of the system. And most of the people I speak to, they kind of say, data for now, that's just your back-end database, that's going to work the way it always has. And I haven't yet seen many people come up with a sort of compelling immutable data vision or something like that. And I'd be interested to hear what other people on the panel, if you like, or in this chat, think about that. Let's start it off with that.
I think there's kind of what we're talking about really kind of an abstraction layer. When we look at infrastructure, cloud infrastructure, and whether the bits of it are immutable or not, one of the things that we've learned when we moved, especially when we moved to Amazon initially Amazon didn't have the idea of a persistent server. Like when you shut your server down, it was gone. And so I think that kind of forced this thinking of this abstraction layer where you're thinking at the level of service and then the data that's needed by that service and generated by that service, and the infrastructure below it is kind of becomes this fuzzy thing that you don't really particularly care about. So you don't really care what happens to your servers. But obviously you do care about your data, and so you have to have a strategy and architecture that maintains the data. I don't think immutability is a goal in itself, that we have to try to make everything immutable. Obviously we don't want that. It's just that we now are classifying there are bits of those things, as we've been saying, there's bits of those things that we can control, and it's often useful to treat those in an immutable way or a way where we're managing change, I guess, a bit more rigorously than maybe we used to for some of these things, but also being aware that there's elements of the infrastructure or elements of the services that we don't want to be mutable in our data.
I think it's a really important point, Keith, that you just made there about immutability in itself is not a goal. What we're driving towards is this a greater clarity about what should be mutable, what should be not. Because actually, really simplistically, you want your data to be mutable because that's the source of your revenue, right? You don't want data to be static and to have to be verified. You want new data coming in. So certain things, a small number of things, are really important to have precisely as mutable. That's where the value comes in. So you can have the same pattern if you consider a jar file and a configuration file. Configuration file is the data, if you like, and we might update that, but we don't want to have to rebuild the jar file from source just to change it. I mean, we've got a distinction between something which definitely should be immutable and something which is immutable. We've got the same pattern at different levels of abstraction, if you like. So we're learning from, as you said, Andrew, we're learning from existing kind of good practice from building and deploying these systems and applying it at different levels of abstraction, different scales, if you like. So we've dealt with a deploying single application scale, we're now dealing with the kind of multiple server scale, but the same sort of pattern. So in the same way that we want always to be able to change the configuration without having to rebuild the jar file, we ought to be able to we want to make sure we keep our data separate from our servers, which we treat as immutable. So in my view, we're learning to apply well-tested patterns in a different level of magnification, if you like.
I think you touched on a very important point there, the separation between servers and data. And the nice thing that happens with if you build your infrastructure with immutable components is that data and state is really siloed. There is no way that data leaks into your application servers or you start caching on your application servers, something like that, because that server will just be gone in whenever, basically. And I think that's very, like, there's a very clear separation between here is state, this state is going to change, like, we're going to have updates, and from time to time, we're going to change the schema of the database and stuff like that. But that can be stateful. That's no problem. We don't need to build this immutable because how often do we change database schemas? It's just it doesn't give us that much advantage to build that immutable. But it really is a big advantage to have the application servers, something that changes constantly immutable. And then we know that there's a very clear firewall between those two where data doesn't leak in, we don't lose anything. And even in the future, like, we're not going to move data into that server because it's just not, or state into that server because it's just not possible.
I think there's an interesting point there. So, Flo, you mentioned that, you know, there's a very clear line between your data and, say, your servers and your infrastructure. And Matthew, you mentioned configuration. And I think there's this thing where, so often configuration is data, but we treat it as data. But actually, in some cases, we don't. And so, this is one thing I think is interesting. So, where configuration is something that can be driven and managed through that infrastructure as code kind of way, so you can put it in your chef recipes or what have you, and that's how you configure things, versus configuration that maybe comes through a UI, and then that's treated as data. And there's this kind of a tension when we're designing things to think about how can we take more things out of being the kind of volatile type data. And so for me, that one of the key classic examples is the build a CI tool or build pipeline tool like Go or Jenkins or what have you. You know, you configure it through the UI, and then you have to. It's always a struggle, I found it, to figure out quite how to manage that data. You really like it to be more probably driven in the way that your configuration and your infrastructure is.
Yeah, and we've actually struggled with that quite a bit, actually, Keith. Where we've tried to automate the creation of not only the Jenkins machine, but configuring jobs with a DSL, and it turns into this basically this giant yak shave and a very difficult exercise. So I kind of think there will be an additional evolution of CI tools that are actually easier for people to script and to automate in that way, because that is a pain point, definitely.
Okay, so aside from throwing a gratuitous plug for Exa Release in here, which is another CDCI tool that you should probably look at, I think the point worth making, and I think this is a good point, but this comes also back down to shifting boundaries between what you control and don't control. I think in the past, people often looked at their pipeline or their CI tool as kind of that is the boundary that you don't control, if you like. So, you know, I control the stuff that goes in, but I don't get to set up this server. And ironically, there's obviously quite a few services out there nowadays that are running hosted CI/CD services. Flo can tell us all about that. So then you are again kind of asking yourself, do I want or need to control that particular boundary, or do I just say, okay, well, I have my bit, they run whatever infrastructure they have, and then that's all good. I think one interesting point that's come up, and I think that's very important, I also remember from the answers, immutable infrastructure isn't a goal as and of itself, I think. Just as CI and CD and then Agile and, you know, whatever you pick, DevOps, you know, you have to think about this thing in the context of what things you're trying to prevent and what things you're trying to achieve within your organization. I mean, I'm very passionate about it. I think it solves a lot of problems we have and a lot of the people we speak to have, but it's not a silver bullet like anything else is. And I think that's very important. So you need to ask yourself, I mean, maybe the most important thing in your organization is that the coffee's bad and that your developers can't work because they're just not awake. So, you know, if that's the problem, then that's what you should be fixing. And so I think maybe it will also be very interesting to hear from the other people in the chat what you feel this thing is actually well built to solve and maybe things it's not so well built to solve.
That's a really important point, Andrew. And I think as techies, if you like, we like to play with this stuff. We like to get involved with it, and it's really cool, and that's all great. But there's a danger that we kind of forget about looking for, you know, the single constraint in the organization, looking for the thing which is really blocking that organization from doing what it wants to do. And we'll jump on this thing, or perhaps people within the organization might jump on a new tool or approach like immutable infrastructure and say, right, this is going to solve all our problems. But that may well be either, it might be useful in the long run for that organization, but it's not the right thing to do now, or it may well be a complete distraction. At a really, really small scale, we did done some work with a client recently, and that their software is the leader in their particular field, but it was up until now it's all been on premise. So they got deployed into 3,000 client sites on premise in the UK, and they've decided to offer a SaaS version, and they're moving into Azure and re-platforming into Azure, but it'll take a long time. And one thing which we kind of worked with them on was how to avoid going down a DevOps rabbit hole of tooling and infrastructure configuration and Docker and whatever else, because the danger was that because they had no ops experience, because they hadn't been running stuff in the cloud at all, it all been on-premise, that the danger that if they hired a whole load of DevOps engineers, that they'd head down this hole of load of tooling and all sorts of craziness and actually not achieve their goal, which was slowly over time to migrate their existing 3,000 clients onto their SaaS product. And I think that was, for me, was a microcosm of a problem which kind of I see quite a lot, which is, there can be too much of a focus on a particular approach or tool or perhaps a couple of tools together that people think are really going to solve the problem, when actually, as Andrew said, maybe it's not the coffee machine, but maybe it is, for example, the organization refuses to limit the work in progress going through the different dev teams and refuses to cross-prioritize across different programs of work and insists on pushing lots and lots of work down towards these dev teams or even worse, down towards straight towards the ops team saying, hey, please update this store procedure or please make this database change. And that's where the real problem is in some organizations that we've seen. And actually dropping a load of tooling might not actually have that much of a benefit. I can see for lots of organizations this stuff will, if they're already quite advanced in the way that they plan and attack the work and fund the work and make it visible and things. But for some organizations, things like immutable infrastructure, new techniques like Docker and stuff like this are probably a big distraction. It's really important that people really understand what problem they're trying to solve when they're looking at quite a new approach like this.
Yeah, I definitely have to echo what you're saying there, Matthew, and sort of a follow-on point is I think when customers often approach, hey, I want to containerize this or I want immutable infrastructure or whatever, not only do they not necessarily have that level of competence, right, internally and structurally, they don't have the processes and procedures, but they also don't realize how much additional tooling on top of that is going to be required to achieve that objective, right, especially with immutable infrastructure. Sure, you can have tools build these containers or images or whatever it is, but then you have to have a whole management and orchestration layer. You have to have patterns for how you're going to deploy and undeploy these containers or images or whatever it is. And I think when you're just approaching it from, wouldn't this be great? Isn't this a silver bullet that can solve, my errors in production or reliability or whatever? You don't realize that actually to achieve that kind of nirvana, you still need a whole bunch of other plumbing and a lot of infrastructure to make that go.
I said container syndrome, but
yeah, I think that for a lot of, I think it's a very big shift in a lot of teams that they now, as Julian said, like approaching this as a software model, basically, where the way you treat infrastructure is with software. So you need to build all that plumbing, you need to build all that pieces, put those pieces in place just to make that work, is a very different way that teams have worked in the past. And I think that it really makes sense if you focus on productivity. I think there's a lot more companies that are being started now, a lot more teams in larger corporations that where really small teams can get a lot of stuff done because they are able to automate everything and really have full and really treat your infrastructure as software. But it demands a completely different way of how to think about your process, and not just in terms of the technology and how to release it, but how do I think about like selecting features to implement on. I deploy it, cannot like weekly sprints and Scrum, for example, doesn't really work that well with that anymore. It's just a very different way to work. So you have to shoehorn different pieces and different experiences from the past into this new model, and I think that's a big problem for a lot of teams.
Well, I feel like we've been a little bit negative about immutable infrastructure up until this point of the discussion, so I think we should probably talk about what's good about immutable infrastructure. Now, maybe I'll start off by saying, you know, for me, as an engineering manager, what it really brings to the table is there's none of this, well, it worked on my laptop kind of syndrome, right? Because the runtime that you're delivering to the customer or into production or whatever is the same runtime that you built on the build environment or maybe on the developer's laptop or whatever it is. And the reverse of that is also if there's faults that are seen in a deployed environment, right, it's very easy to simply say, well, that container is available over here, and for you to download that onto your laptop and reproduce the customer's problem or whatever, it's super simple. There's none of this, hey, I definitely need to SSH into this production machine in order to do X, Y, Z and mess around with it, right? It gives that kind of good isolation, separation of duties, and reproducibility. So that, to me, is one of the benefits, I think, of immutable infrastructure. I'd love to hear what everybody else in the panel thinks is a benefit.
Yeah, for me, it's... It's a good way to kind of counter the dev oops, which is now that we've got these kind of automation tools, and I'll pick on Chef just because you're here, Julian. But you know, any of those tools where it's like, right, I can make a change here, and now bam, it's going to go out to hundreds or thousands of servers all at once. You know, it's really easy to screw up a lot of stuff really quickly. So taking that kind of discipline, and I think it might have been you, Andrew, who compared it to the software. Artifacts, how we handle gems and WAR files and all that kind of thing, and saying, actually, we shouldn't be making changes directly in production. We should be managing those changes, in a more staged way, so that there's less variability and less kind of, less risk, I guess, of what's going to happen when we get into production.
It's a very good point that was made. We've been talking about what I think are considered pretty advanced and realistic challenges about containers, but I mean, if you look at them, those of you who are joining who haven't seen necessarily the document that Marco put together, I think there is the panel here has a very positive view in general, so don't get the impression that we're whole container bashers. I think we're just pointing out some of the things that appear at scale. Yeah, I think one of the key things about containers that is interesting is that, everybody, I don't think anybody would stand up really and shout loudly, oh, it's a really good thing when we make untraceable changes to any system. But I think the reality in the past has been that just the trade-off between how complicated it is and how much time it takes to make a server change in a kind of versioned, controlled way just meant that, if you had a production file that was burning, you were just going to log into the box and make a change because it was orders of magnitude faster than baking a new AMI or a new, something in your mainframe or whatever, although actually mainframes did this pretty well. So I think one of the nice things about containers and specifically some of the technologies coming about is that they simply remove, a lot of this difference in terms of the time it takes to make a mutable change versus the time it takes to make an immutable change. Provided, of course, you have the orchestration and the glue and the plumbing. And I mean, we all know, ultimately, these are human beings using tools, and we know that if you give human beings a process or a tool set that makes things harder and more complicated, they're going to find ways around it. Because we don't like doing that stuff. And the great thing to me about containers is we can finally align what I think we've known to be best practice for a long time with the convenience that actually is required to make people use it.
Sorry if I interject, guys, but there is a question David has been writing in the Q&A, and he's struggling to actually get support from management and operations. So this is definitely, in between the technology and the people aspect, but it's one of the challenges. So David, if you can write more details about the critique, the feedback you got from management and operation, or pushing back, it would help. But if you guys on the panel have any experience or recommendation on how to push this through when you got management and operations pushing back, that would be great.
For me, one of the challenges, one of the key things that organizations need to think about when bringing in new stuff like this, basically when building cloud systems, is it boils down to something like this. Do you run your infrastructure capability as a team that talks, that communicates a lot with the application development? Do you want a lot of collaboration there? or do you actually want to treat your internal operational capability as if it were Amazon or Azure or some other, in other words, as an infrastructure as a service or platform service? Because when you think about things like Conway's Law and the implications of how much communication different teams have with each other, we've known about the effects of Conway's Law for a long time, which is, the shape of systems we build is determined by the communication patterns between teams. We've known that for application software for quite a while, but if we think about our infrastructure at the whole system level, then if we want to consume our infrastructure as a service, it sort of implies that the infrastructure team needs to not communicate with the development teams as much. Or if we're building an internal platform as a service, then maybe we actually want to limit the amount of communication they have. And that has implications for the sorts of conversations we have and the way in which we pitch things. Does that make sense? So the sorts of responsibilities that overlap between our application teams or product or service teams and the teams that are involved in infrastructure. If we've got end-to-end teams that deal with everything, then that's fine. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is to actually define kind of boundary between the two. And then that's a different kind of conversation when you're trying to get buy-in. So like you even need to work out what kind of conversation. Do you need to bring everyone on board, or do you actually decide to kind of split the problem, if you like, and to only need to talk to a smaller group of people?
Yeah, I think another important point there, Matthew, that you kind of touched on is, you know, the shape of an infrastructure team can often change in this new world, right? And a lot of the pushback that I've seen from customers, from management, senior management, is they're fearing that, you know, immutable infrastructure or automation or cloud services or whatever are going to put these folks that are in the infrastructure team out of a job. And it's really more just, well, actually, your job's going to change, but, you know, you try to have to sell the positive, right? Your job's going to change for the better when you're not treating your servers as pets and going on there and monkeying around with individual config files and, oh my god, the system can never go down and this sort of thing, right? Your job becomes more of a conductor, right? You're more managing pieces that are actually bending at your will, right? And it's no longer like the traditional kind of old school, you know, Unix or mainframe administrator. And I think just making it clear that actually it's not about getting rid of people or automating folks out of work. It's about just changing the responsibilities to be more of a thinking kind of work rather than just, you know, monkeys, basically, infrastructure monkeys. And kind of framing it in that positive way, that I think that in my experiences has actually led to some pretty good outcomes.
Okay, so David just added some details, and if you can see, I currently selected it. He says that the fact that container encapsulate everything and the risk, it's seen as, you know, a problem. So people feel it's more risky, actually, than the old manual semi-automated processes. But I guess very specific.
Which is also, I mean, up to point, that's a fair point for management to make of, like, this is a very new way to work. Like, we'll need some kind of proof that this actually makes sense. So I think that, as with most things, trying to put it into a very small project, get an early win, get a very small early win, and then moving from there into the organization is probably the best way. As management, it's really hard, like in a large corporation, it's really hard to say, we're going to bet everything on Docker now in all of our infrastructure. That's just very risky. So showing like these small wins, these small projects that turn out really, really well with Docker, and then taking it from there. And I think teaching the rest of the team, teaching the rest of the company, that this actually is something that is really meaningful and would make a big difference. This will take time, of course, but that's just how people work, I think. You have to show those small wins before you can really move big in most corporations.
And you have to make them measurable. I mean, I think it's perfectly fair, I think, for somebody to turn around and say, well, you're basically telling me you're going to replace foo with bar, so why is bar better than foo? And if you just say, well, I think it's better because I read an article on some blog, that's not a credible justification. If your kids came home and said they wanted you to do that, you'd say, this is, I'm not going to do it. So, you know, if you're going to get that win, I mean, you are, unfortunately, and I think the industry as a whole will have to do this, your challenge is a microcosm of a much bigger challenge. You're going to have to define what the problem is that you have right now and how containers are going to make that better. And I think, mean, but this is something I've spoken about at length in other places as well. The governance model for containers is still a little bit up in the air, because the whole point, and whatever full stack delivery model you choose, I mean, containers are just a very extreme version of that. You are basically asking somebody to sign off on something that spans, in general, the areas of responsibility of two parts of your organization, like the dev code, if you like, and the platform side of things. And different approaches to this problem exist. You know, some people say, well, look, we're just going to run your container in a sandbox. If you screw up really badly by configuring open SSH ports and all that kind of bad practice stuff, you're just going to have to fix it. And other organizations, they have a quite a rigorous review process of containers, and then they try to do code analysis, if you like, on those containers to try to automate part of that process. So that I don't think there's a well-defined way of solving that problem right now. And I mean, I think to me, one of the interesting things with containers, and we talked about it a bit earlier with the comparison with orchestration and dependencies and all these things, we're taking a lot of problems from the development space that we've kind of solved when we're building a WAR file, and we're now moving them over into the runtime space, like dependency management and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, a lot of stuff is still a little bit up in the air. So if you're in a sort of traditional, rather risk-averse organization where they're saying, whoa, this looks like version one of everything, we're going to wait to see how things pan out, then I can kind of understand that. If you do this in a small sandbox in your organization as well, and then you will learn along with the industry.
I think one of the points that Andrew, that I want to point out that you're making there is, like, there's existing, like, there, what's missing in this whole ecosystem right now with containerization is, like, an automated way to acceptance test the container. All right, there's no real framework that you can poke at that container and be like in a standard way and say, does this container meet some certain specifications? It's not the same as, you know, WAR files, for example, where, you know, if you're building a WAR file, you can then take that artifact, you know, as part of your Jenkins, your Go or whatever pipeline, and then, you know, you could take that WAR file, spin up a small servlet instance around it, like a Jetty or whatever, and run a bunch of tests against that, and, you know, there you go. But containers, I don't know, like, because there's so much surface there, so much attack surface, so many potential vulnerabilities and errors, right? I don't think anybody, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, folks on the panel, but if you know of any systems that can automatically, you know, acceptance test to see whether or not that containers meet some certain audit or control criteria, you know, I think that's an area where there's definitely a lot of development to be done.
So I wanted to, on the topic of the kind of organizational change, I think one of the driving things around this is essentially self-service. So it's moving away from this idea of, we're talking about how we organize our teams and infrastructure and ops and all those kind of things. It's moving away from one team builds something and then hands it over to another team, or, you know, you have teams who have to kind of be, when things need to be done, I want a server, I want this or that, that has to go to somebody who's going to make decisions and build it, to this kind of self-service. And so the in that kind of scenario of to enable, in order to enable self-service but maintain standards, all these kind of tools, the cloud stuff, infrastructure service, platform as a service, is a way to try to get regularity there. So again, inside that company who's saying, oh, we're not really sure about this stuff, I think the wedge is, well, we want self-service, you know, we need to have self-service because that's the only way that things are going to really, you know, scale and be able to innovate quickly. And so in order to make self-service an acceptable thing, you need to have, you know, better change management, you need to have standardization of what you're giving to people. And that includes stuff like, so to kind of roundabout go back to Julian's point around testing, it is being able to be in, okay, so you've given somebody the ability to make their own containers. We also want to run that through automated tests without having to wait for somebody, some people to go and do that, poke at it by hand, to say, yeah, this meets our criteria and we're happy to let this container go through into production. I mean, I would think to the tools question, I mean, I think that a lot of this kind of standard tools for testing, you know, you're testing this kind of self-contained thing that you can spin up and poke at the ports and those kind of things. I mean, I would, you know, tend to use tools like, you know, server spec or other RSpec type things. There's a lot of hand-rolling involved, though, I would say.
I
I think one of the things that changes there as well is the responsibility of the dev teams need to expand. They need to understand that at this point, what they build, they run what they build. If you have, as Matthew said before, that separation of like operations is more like a service company inside the company, then whatever development hands over, if they hand over a Docker container and run it there, then if that Docker container dies for whatever reason internally, unless it's like really an infrastructure problem, then the development team is responsible for fixing that. It's not the operations team anymore that needs to fix this, because the artifact that is the operations team is only responsible for running the, for example, Docker infrastructure, but the development team, whatever they push into that, they're responsible for it. And I think that throwing code over the wall kind of workflow that seems to be still happening in a lot of larger companies is just goes completely out of the door, because you cannot have that anymore if you really put like containers into that, I think.
Although to be fair, I think, Florian, what you're saying is you throw a container over the wall. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, I think I think PaaS is a very interesting, very now again trendy. It's gone through its sort of trend cycle of codifying this notion of the wall. We don't call it the wall anymore; it's the platform, but it's the same kind of thing. And I think the irony with Docker is a great example in a case in point, because I think it was you, Julian, who was saying that, or might be you, Keith. Pretty much everybody nowadays seems to be figuring out how to build a PaaS on top of Docker. And the irony for me there is to realize that, you know, companies like a Cloud Firewall company, organizations, Cloud Firewall, OpenShift, have been doing this for like 5 years, and they figured out it's hard. And I'm pretty sure everybody else will figure out within 6 months that it's hard. And then they'll lose some of their enthusiasm for doing this. But there, again, I think you can see a very interesting trade-off. Do you use a container technology as basically an underlying implementation thing, and you decide to come up with an even higher abstraction boundary, which is sort of the classic PaaS model, give me code, and then the fact that I happen to build a container based on this code is nothing you should care about, or give me a container, which gives you much more flexibility in terms of what you want to do in that container, but I realistically have to push some of the runtime responsibility back to you. And I think we're seeing models like, you know, Google obviously is doing some of this, where you can have your cake and eat it in the sense that you can choose both. Like, you can on the one hand say, look, I want to do anything I can possibly do in my container, but on the flip side, the runtime will not give you all kinds of guarantees about scalability, auto-monitoring, all this kind of stuff, because I can't, right? You're giving me arbitrary stuff. I can get it running, but that's about it, versus saying, well, if you're willing to stick to a narrower interface, then I can start to give you all kinds of promises, because I can, you know, guarantee that the app server it runs on or whatever. And I think one of the really nice things about container technology is that it can allow you to choose the slider where it makes sense for you as a team or as an organization.
Yeah, I think that's right. You have the how deep you want to go in that stack. I think it's up to you. It depends on the problem and the team involved. I mean, ideally, you want to kind of stay as high a level of abstraction as you can, so that you don't have to dig down and do all that kind of work of mucking around with containers and virtual machines and then hardware. But for some problems, you have to. But I kind of take exception to the you know, so I don't think it has to be, it shouldn't be, that we're still just throwing things over the wall, we're just throwing different things, we're throwing containers. I think really the ideal is to kind of topple that wall and say that, and as Matthew was talking about with the whole, you know, building that internal PaaS kind of thing, of the wall becomes a horizontal thing. So, you know, I own software, I'm a development team, and I own that all the way through to production, and what's kind of below in terms of what's it running on, whether I'm thinking at the container level or the VM level or whatever, is owned by somebody else who manages that from front to back. So in my development systems, they're managing it there, and if something goes wrong, catch it there. Yeah, so it shouldn't be that I'm just packaging it in a different way and handing it to somebody else to worry about.
So I think that's where a lot of operations management pushes back, though, exactly on that, because like the promise is the developer says, I want Heroku, right? And that's where the internal PaaS initiatives come from. But the difference between Heroku and your internal PaaS is, if something blows up on Heroku, Heroku is going to be like, well, that's your problem, right? We're just paying for the bits to be running. Whereas if it's running, if an internal PaaS is running in your company, you have somebody that's running the servers or whatever for the developers to go and run around and say, fix fix this thing for me, right? Fairly or unfairly. And so that's where a lot of, like, that's where the difference is, I think. So definitely, I think the organizational points that we talked about, the organizational issues that we talked about earlier, those have to be addressed as part of onboarding, you know, whether it's containerization or other internal PaaS technologies into your world.
It's the responsibility. The responsibility has to be aligned. So if you're saying, I want Heroku, and I just want to be able to push my applications into production whenever I want without you combing over it and telling me whether I can or not, then that's fine. But when the application blows up, you know, that's mine, right? It has to be. And I think some organizations haven't reached that point. They're trying to do the one without realigning the responsibility. And, yeah, if I was an ops, I would push back, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I think one... Sorry, go on, Flo.
No, go ahead, please.
I was just going to mention that it strikes me that if we line up a few things beforehand, immutable infrastructure has a strong potential for improving the runtime effectiveness of the system that we're building, basically increasing operability, because the dev or product or service team, whatever, are forced to have to think about more stuff about how this thing runs in production, because the ops teams can't come in later and kind of hack around with a load balancer or make a few little tweaks here and there. You have to specify this up front, and that is a good thing, right? So we're specifying more about how this thing should work beforehand. We're testing it all in a deployment pipeline, flowing it down, and because we know we can rebuild it and reinstantiate it because it's immutable, that's good, right? We're bringing more operability, like, under the control of a kind of software-defined, you know, software development, basically. That has to be a good thing, in general.
Right. So TLDR, if the developers know what they're asking for in terms of the features and their associated responsibilities, then immutable infrastructure will work very well for all parties involved.
Mm-hmm. So I would, I'm mindful of time. I would close with a last round of where do people start, considering that most people have some legacy stuff. So it's easy to start when, you know, from scratch. What if, you know, I'm not starting from scratch?
I think, I mean, in most, especially larger organizations, there must be small applications or small new tools that are built on the side or small new internal things that are built on the side. Try to find something like that. Try to find something that is not mission critical, that is possibly internal, that when it blows up, it doesn't blow up the business, and start going from there to convince the rest of the team, if the rest of the company, or if you have to convince somebody else and show them real data. I think that finding those small things, finding those small wins, and moving them into services is a good way to start, and a very small way to start.
And of course, if that particular, if you can find a service which is largely read rather than read-write, as in not transactional, that makes it even easier, right? Because there's a whole, as we said before, there's a whole class of problems relating to data persistence which just disappear if it's an entirely read application, it's a set of data feeds or something, or it's the read part of a CQRS based system. That could be, you could do get some benefit from doing that, and it means that you can deliver that stuff with confidence. We're just reading data. We don't have to worry about the persistence part. So that would be another good thing to look for when looking for that first service or application if it's read only.
It could also help to in terms of getting the kind of go ahead and the, you know, the budget and that kind of thing, can help if you've got a small suitable part of the system which there's already kind of a drive to, oh, we know we need to change, we want to make some changes here, and so that can help. Although it can also bite you if you pick something that's very high pressure. And you know, you start getting that pressure to get it out there quickly, and you kind of have to do shortcuts. And so it's balance.
We also see a lot of enterprises moving their legacy monolith applications to a decomposed service-oriented architecture kind of world, right? And that's the perfect time to consider a move to at least some of those services, a move to making them immutable, especially if they're going to be like as Andrew was, or Matthew, sorry, was pointing out, sort of that stateless 12-factor application, right? Those are the perfect candidates, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you got to get around that data thing by offloading it, right? So, you know, something like Amazon or what have you, where you've got, you know, you can put it onto an RDS and let somebody else worry about that.
services all the way.
What I maybe done.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I think I might be a step more boring than that and say find a quantified problem
that you have to solve with whatever services that you're attacking. And obviously not the biggest one under the sun, but you know, I think that the question from David in the middle was a very good sort of reality check level set. You know, you are going to have to go and sell this, and the people you're selling it to will not believe you because you say containers are the solution to everything. So find a problem that you have, like whether it's time to recovery, whether it's, you know, number of incidents that are occurring, number of times you've had a firefight, oh, it worked on my laptop, whatever. Make that a quantified problem and see how containers can solve that, you know, and then get them some numbers to show that they really make stuff better.
Cool. So, guys, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for participating in the original Britain Q&A and also for making the time to do this hangout. You know, it was Thanksgiving for those of you on the other side of the pond yesterday, so I'm sure, you know, a bit of a hangover. It's late for someone else, so thank you very much for making the time. The video is probably immediately available on YouTube, and then I will put together a little page with a summary and the embedded video and the original PDF, so it's going to be easier for people to watch it again. With that said, have a good weekend, and thank you very much again.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye.